Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And it's like listening to the voice of Osama bin Laden from beyond the grave. Today, West Point's Combating Terrorism Center released 17 out of the thousands of documents seized from the al-Qaeda leader's Abbottabad compound in Pakistan after he was killed during that Navy SEAL raid last year. Among the documents, letters written by bin Laden in which he worried about how to manage the sprawling al-Qaeda groups, how to keep them in line. Hans Nichols is Bloomberg News White House correspondent. Hans, you've seen these documents. Overall, what sort of picture do you take from, again, these 17 documents?
I guess it's the immediacy that jumps out at me. I mean, some of these were right up to the moment that he was killed. So these 17 letters, and it's important to note that, it is, as you did, this is just a small fraction of the documents and the intel that was seized from that compound. But these 17 letters are from 2006 to 2011. And you have commentary on things like the Arab Spring, on, you know, not settling for some sort of, you know, half deal, that these revolutionaries should keep pushing and keep pushing for full Islamic states. Some of these things are so immediate, that's kind of what jumps out at me right away.
Yeah, well, and continue with what you're seeing, because we're reading, for instance, one in which he writes, "I plan to release a statement that we're starting a new phase to correct," and then in parentheses, "the mistakes we made." What is he talking about?
I think throughout you see concern, especially with the affiliate groups, that A, bin Laden didn't control the affiliate groups, and B, that the affiliate groups were attacking fellow Muslims. And I think that's something that you see throughout, both sort of a theological problem and a moral one of attacking fellow Muslims, but also the PR aspect of it. I think overall what you see from this is that bin Laden was very sensitive to public perceptions. It almost reads like a branding document at times, talking about changing the name of al-Qaeda, so the U.S. war on al-Qaeda could be something more like, you know, a war on something that was a little more fluffy and had more sort of pro-Muslim or pan-Muslim aspects to it.
Well, you speak of the different al-Qaeda groups. There's documents from bin Laden's advisor, the American Adam Gadan. In one, he urges him to disassociate al-Qaeda from the acts of the spin-off operation in Iraq. In another, he writes about American media. Again, this is al-Qaeda spokesman Adam Gadan. He cites 60 Minutes as an important news program. He singles out Brian Ross of ABC as someone who covers terrorist activities. What's the sense, you know, that you get of they might have been isolated in Pakistan, but very much in touch with the world?
Well, it's a little bit of both, right? So you see isolation, but you also see from that isolation, and they're almost looking through a straw at the U.S. and getting an incomplete picture, drawing conclusions from that. So elsewhere in the report, there's a desire to assassinate the president, in part so that Vice President Joe Biden could become president, and then in bin Laden's view, Biden is, you know, uniquely, manifestly unqualified for the presidency.
Utterly unprepared is the quotation.
Yeah, right. Now, you know, we can all have debates about Joe Biden and where he stands on the political spectrum, but the man was a senator for over 30 years. He's well-versed in most national security issues. He is a senator with a portfolio that's quite broad and quite thick in terms of international affairs. So there's an attempt there to be an analysis of American culture, and in this case, American politics, but I discount a lot of it, and that it doesn't seem to ring true to me.
And there were reportedly, as we said, thousands of documents seized. Do we have any way of knowing if these were cherry-picked to kind of put bin Laden in the worst light, because he does seem sort of admitting mistakes and trying to reorganize?
That's a reasonable assumption, but I couldn't say for certain without knowing what the entire data set looked like. But if you try to think of 17 other letters that showed al-Qaeda in worse light, you'd kind of be hard-pressed to come up with some. You have upset with, sort of frustration with the Iranians. You have frustration with the Pakistanis, people that potentially could have alliances with al-Qaeda. You have great frustration with all the affiliate groups. If this is not the dirtiest laundry of al-Qaeda, I'd be curious to see what could be dirtier.
Hans Nichols, Bloomberg News White House correspondent, on the 17 documents that were seized from the Osama bin Laden compound last year that have now been released. We've posted them at hereandnow.org. It is fascinating reading, and I'm sure people will be coming up with further analysis as we get to look more closely at them. But for today, Hans Nichols, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You may have heard the moment on last Sunday's Meet the Press when the predictable patter came to an abrupt halt. MSNBC host Rachel Maddow was trying to talk about policy and, in passing, cited the U.S. Census Bureau statistic that, on average, women still make 77 cents to the dollar made by men. But CNN contributor and Republican strategist Alex Castellanos disagreed with the statistic. Meet the Press host David Gregory refereed. Let's listen.
All right, let Rachel frame it, though, the way she laid it up.
Right now, women are making 77 cents on the dollar for what men are making.
But that's not true. If so,
every
greedy businessman in America would hire only women, save 25%, and be hugely
profitable. I feel like this is actually, it's weird that you're interrupting me and not letting me make my point, because we get along so well, so let me make my point.
I will.
But it is important, I think, the interruption is important, I think, because now we know, at least from both of your perspective, that women are not faring worse than men in the economy, that women aren't getting paid less for equal work. I think that's a serious basis, a difference in factual understanding of the world.
Now, Castellanos said that there were other factors, like hours worked, that created the gap. But the next day, his network did an analysis, and here's what CNN's Lisa Sylvester found.
Even if you control for everything you could possibly imagine, all those things, the college, the hours work, there, men still make more than women. That gap narrows. It's about 5 cents of a difference, but it is still there. It's still real. And the truth is men make more than women.
And on her show, Rachel Maddow reiterated she was actually trying to talk about policy, not statistics.
If you don't recognize that there's a problem with women getting paid less than men, then policy debates about how to fix something that's not really a problem just don't seem that important to you. And so you downplay the importance of policy, and you can't understand why everybody keeps saying this war on women thing is going on.
So today we want to bring in Linda Barrington. She's managing director of Cornell University's Institute for Compensation Studies. We're going to talk the wage gap with Linda, and let's start with stats. Do women, on average, make less than men?
Yes, they are paid less. And the debate is over how much less and why they're paid less.
Well, and what is your sense of how much less and why?
When you do the kinds of controls, comparing people with the same education, the same years of experience in the same job, then the gap is around 5%. If you have a raw gap or unadjusted, which is the 77 cents that Rachel was using and is just a comparison of the ratio of earnings, not taking account of what jobs people are doing, whether they're working part-time or full-time, what kind of education level they have.
So stay with the 5% gap. That's still a huge gap. If you're talking high-level jobs, $200,000, a 5% gap is a big gap.
It is a big gap. And I think no one would say, oh, I don't want a 5% raise if it were offered.
Right. Right.
So it is a significant amount. Where the ideology and the argument comes in on that last 5% is whether that last 5% is discrimination, or is it that there are other things that we haven't been able to control for that really explain the gap in the sense of what we would call productivity. Things like how well you negotiated your starting salary in the mm-hmm. first place.
So in other words, maybe women are not negotiating their salaries as well as men.
Exactly. And there is evidence that men are much more likely. There's great work done by Linda Babcock with a book called Women Don't Ask. Mm-hmm. You know, men are more likely to negotiate for that first salary, and that first salary gets compounded with every raise thereafter.
So this is, again, we're talking about this 5% gap, women, men doing the same exact job and not getting equal pay for equal work. Is there a sense, though, that there may be some discrimination, a mindset? Women will tell anecdotally about, for instance, being told, oh, well, you don't have a family to support. That's still happening.
That is still happening. So it's a question of how much can we see that discrimination coming into play. Discrimination is important to talk about because when we get down to that 5%, it doesn't mean that that's the only place that discrimination takes place. So part of the difficulty in sorting out the facts here is that there could have been a lot of discrimination along the way. So the fact that women are over 95% of speech-language pathologists, and they're only 4.3% of aircraft pilots and flight engineers. Yes, that was a choice, but there's social pressure and some discrimination that tracks women into certain jobs. So once you control for those jobs, it doesn't mean there's no discrimination. It just means once those women become flight engineers, now how does their pay differ from men?
Right. And you talk about other, what you call micro inequities. Again, you might not call it blatant discrimination, but if women don't have as much mentorship, if they don't have as many champions in the workplace yet, again, they may have that 5% difference in salary?
Absolutely. And the micro inequities are those things that when you experience, you feel in your gut and you know that someone has not treated you fairly, but it is really hard to prove that in a court of law or to show it statistically. One of my experiences with that was in graduate school. I had a classmate who was telling us in a study session what to emphasize or not because the professor said it would be more this topic than that topic. And I said, well, when did he say that in class? And he was like, no, he said it in the pickup basketball game. Mm-hmm. And that was a pickup basketball game with all male classmates and all male faculty. That kind of thing plays out in the long run, right? Those are the kind of little differences that might show up in a test score or might show up in a performance review that are very hard to track.
Are you listening, President Obama? Because he'd been criticized for not including some of the women in the White House in his pickup games and things like that. Talk about the wider pay discrepancies, you know, the 77%. Again, we're not talking about the people doing the same exact job, the same exact experience, the same exact hours, which is the 5% discrepancy. Talk about the 77 cents on the dollar. How is that arrived at?
That's simply looking at, depending on the measure, annual income for men and annual income for women. You know, the term is called the raw wage gap, and I think that that's an appropriate characteristic because it is just the top line difference. In some sense, that is the most important number because it does say what spending power women have versus men. It does say something about the bargaining power within the household that women have compared to men. And I would say the one thing about discussion of the importance of policy is that it kind of ignores some of the more subtle discrimination that perhaps happens in the household. So we are used to thinking about employers discriminating and not offering women the training. It's a little more uncomfortable for us to think about husbands and wives discriminating and saying, oh, you know, I can't go for that training because I have to pick up the kids after school. So there are larger societal issues, and I think especially for married women and people in two-person households where you're thinking about how do we make decisions about the kids, all of these little decisions roll up into career advancements and career path. We've got more women going to college now than men, but they're not choosing the career paths in college that are going to pay them more. So if you look at that raw wage gap for people who go into community and social services, women actually make 95 cents on the dollar of men, totally uncontrolled. In legal, it's 50 cents on the dollar. So what occupation you go into matters a lot for the wage gap. It also matters for ultimately how much you're paid.
I know, but you just said women aren't choosing the higher salary jobs like lawyers, but when they do, they make 50% less than men. Okay, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, gaps within gaps. But in the meantime, your thoughts. Maybe are you a husband who's seen a working wife discriminated against? Is this a generational thing? Are you an employer who has your reasons for pay inequity that maybe we're not thinking of here? Bring it. HereAndNow.org. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be back in 1 minute with more from Linda Barrington, compensation expert, Here and Now. Welcome back to our conversation about compensation, a topic that blew up on a Meet the Press panel that included MSNBC's Rachel Maddow and Republican consultant Alex Castanadas. He discounted the census stats that she used that showed that, on average, women make less than men. Linda Barrington is managing director of Cornell University's Institute for Compensation Studies. And, Linda, you've been explaining this is complicated. Yes, on average, women make less than men. And, in effect, you were agreeing with Alex that some of that gap has to do with career choices. But you say the choices, have to do with societal pressures. And, by the way, we want to rush to say, of course, we know there are women who are happy working fewer hours, making less and raising their children. But you say there are societal pressures on others. But what about policy? Rachel Maddow was trying to make a point about the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which reset the statute of limitations on lawsuits that can claim pay discrimination, making it easier to file them. What else can be done to close this pay gap policy-wise?
I think the focus on education and making sure that all schools have strong, robust, engaging math and science programs that feels so distant from whether or not a woman in her 50s is making 70 cents on the dollar or 90 cents on the dollar, but it starts that young. And when you look at the gap over time, it has narrowed over time tremendously. I mean, we can go all the way back to the turn of the century when it was 40 cents on the dollar. So we are making progress, but it's also progress generationally. So there is less gap for women entering the workforce today than there was 20 years ago. So should we be trying to catch up and put resources into catching up the women who entered the workforce 20 years ago? There are only so many dollars to go around. Should we be putting those into making sure that women entering the workforce now are going into those jobs that pay them the most? So the other policy point I would make is, are we really enforcing the wage discrimination legislation that's already there? How difficult are we making it for women to form class action lawsuits when there is a pattern of discrimination? So while I'm not a policy expert, I might focus the lens a little more on making sure we're effectively enforcing the existing policy.
Such as?
Part of how women have been able to go into new occupations is that we forced through legislation the elimination of workplace policies that kept them out. So New York City Police Department used to have a height requirement that discriminated against women. And when that was pushed on, there wasn't a good business case for why police officers needed to be a certain height. So looking constantly at what kind of regulations are happening inside the workforce, are women getting the fair, you know, access to training and on the job? Those kind of things matter. If raising children is a big reason women drop out of the workforce for some time and lose that continual on-the-job experience that contributes to wages, then let's, through policy, see how we can make daycare more accessible. And these things also play out in the larger question of just inequality overall. I mean, we are now at a point in this country where we have the greatest income inequality we've ever had. So a lot of the things that would help women advance would also help lower income families do better over time. So as a woman, I absolutely think that pay gap is important, but we need to put it in the larger context of the great inequality we have across both genders in the workplace.
You're talking about the 1%, the 99 versus the 1%.
I am. And actually, recently, the wage gap has gotten to be more of an issue at the high end of the income distribution than at the middle and low end. There's some great work done by Fran Blau and Larry Kahn looking at the gender gap over time. In the 70s, the gap between men and women was the highest for people in the middle of the income distribution, around the 50th percentile.
In other words, middle income earners, men were making far more than women. The gap was biggest in the middle income.
Exactly. Right? And now, while the gap has come down, if you look at the pattern of that gap across rich and poor, the gap is actually larger for people in the top 20% of the income distribution. Now, both men and women are paid more in the top 20% than in the bottom, but the gap between them among the richest 20% or the highest 20% of earners is bigger than the percentage gap at the low end.
What is the gap at the top end?
So when we're looking at the very top of the income distribution, we are getting wage gaps that are well over 30%.
So women are getting into the boardroom, but that's about it. They're not getting into the income that men are making at the higher rates. But poor people, men and women, are making about the same, and it's not a lot.
And when you say about the same, one of the things that I found very striking is when you start thinking about how this plays out across various ethnic communities. we've got that number, which is, you know, overall women are 77 cents on the dollar, 80 cents on the dollar, depending on the study. If you look at African Americans, mm-hmm. women are over 90 cents on the dollar. And if you look at Hispanics, they're just over 90 cents on the dollar. For whites, it's around that 80 cents on the dollar. So why is it that African American women have a lower wage gap than white women? Part of it is that the earning opportunities for black men are so much lower. So simply focusing on the gap is not the end all and be all, right? We need to focus on the total level of earnings. And if we focus on raising that, we're more likely to eliminate some of the big inequalities that we need to be concerned about. We're at a point now where the top 10% of earners in this country are bringing home 50% of all income earned. That's greater than it was in the 20s. I mean, we need to be thinking about that gap. And some of what we can do to raise women's earnings will contribute to that. But I would hate to lose sight of that bigger inequality when we're down to 5 cents on the dollar and trying to figure out how to measure micro inequities and other things to eliminate that last nickel.
It's fascinating. Linda Barrington, Managing Director of Cornell University's Institute for Compensation Studies. Linda, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, we'd love to hear your thoughts on the pay gap at hereandnow.org or facebook.com/hereandnowradio, or you can tweet us at hereandnow. We'd love to hear from you. Latest news is next. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston with Figuring Color, exploring the expressive power of color in paintings and sculpture, icaboston.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and this is a big week for horse racing. It's the start of the Triple Crown season, the first jewel in that crown, Saturday's Kentucky Derby in Louisville. The Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont Stakes, the three Triple Crown races, attract millions of viewers. But three Saturdays a year isn't enough to support a sport that once was the most popular pastime in America. Recently, there was that devastating series in the New York Times about horse injuries and fatalities because of the sport. And all this week, we've been looking at the business of horse racing through the reporting of WEKU Radio in Richmond, Kentucky. Today, WEKU's Jacqueline Carfagno looks at how horse racing hopes to regain its audience.
England's eighth race upcoming, including pick three wagering. No changes in this eighth race.
It's early April in Lexington, Kentucky, and there's not a cloud in the sky on opening day at Kenyon Racecourse. Stands are packed with young and enthusiastic fans in this park-like setting in the heart of thoroughbred breeding country. But this isn't the reality for most of the sport.
The headline is very sobering, and that is that we're losing about 4% of our fan base each year.
Jason Wilson is vice president of business development at the Jockey Club. His job is to stop that loss and revive the fan base. It won't be easy.
Even our core fans are not extremely enthusiastic about the sport. If you look at the numbers, 46% of our core fans would not recommend the sport to another person.
Those core fans say betting systems are out of date, too few horses race, and betting facilities are often run down. Racing ignored or disdained many of the technological disruptions that changed American sports and society. Baseball, football, and basketball took to television, but racing wanted to keep fans and their wagers at the track itself. It was a disastrous strategy. Last year, both pro bowling and poker had more national television time than racing. When tracks finally did expand their reach by simulcasting races to other tracks and off-track betting sites, they made some pretty bad deals. Rogers Beasley directs racing at Keeneland.
We're giving away our product, and it's not something that the NFL or NBA would ever have countenanced, and we have let it run amok.
The result, he said, is less money to invest in fan-friendly technology and facilities. Keeneland, a not-for-profit with revenue from its huge thoroughbred sales operation, is not the norm.
We at Keeneland have been blessed because we always had a nice facility, and I've constantly put money back in the facility. Mm-hmm. That has not been true of 90% of racetracks across America.
First, tell me who you are and what you're doing out here.
Chase Sawyer, and I'm winning some money on some horse races.
A college freshman, Sawyer was at Keeneland on opening day and planned to visit again several times during the 15-day meet. Last fall, Keeneland was the first track in the United States to introduce a smartphone betting app, and Sawyer loves that idea.
I thought it was the coolest thing I've ever seen. I was like, why wait in line for the betting when you could just bet on a phone?
Jason Wilson at the Jockey Club wants to leverage young fans like Sawyer with a fantasy racing game launching this month. Players will pick their horses in real races run each week and be rewarded for spreading the word.
The way that you gain points in order to make your quote-unquote bets is you do a lot of social media activities. So you'll tweet about a story, or you'll go to a Facebook page, or you'll watch a video. And so it's really kind of following them where they congregate and making sure that we're part of their dialogue in the way that they're used to communicating.
How the horse racing industry embraces that high-tech online future will determine whether young fans like Chase Sawyer will see a trip to the track as a quaint outing or a pastime as common as a football game.
That's Jacqueline Carafano from WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky. The 138th running of the Kentucky Derby is on Saturday. Staying with sport for just a second, there have been two deadly accidents in the sailboat racing world. We're going to speak with Gary Jobson, president of the U.S. Sailing Association, tomorrow. But we want to hear from you sailors out there, especially our listeners in California. Accidents were off your coast. Do you think something is wrong with the sport of sail racing? Go to hereandnow.org and weigh in. That's tomorrow. Back in 30 seconds, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. Students at virtually every college and university are asked to evaluate their professors at the end of each semester. And students often look to websites like ratemyprofessor.com before choosing a class. But some professors worry that bad evaluations can be career-ending. And Stanley Fish, a blogger for the New York Times, wonders if they're effective. He says sometimes good teaching includes deliberate confusion. Student evaluations can only recognize and encourage assembly line teaching. Well, we want to take a look at evaluations today with a professor who's joined many in coming up with his own system. He's Mohamed Zuman, a biomedical engineering professor at Boston University. And, Professor, we understand you take an evaluation every 2 weeks?
That is correct.
What do you do? How do you do it?
So the evaluations are actually very simple, Robin. They ask the students, how am I doing? Sort of a numerical score, which is less important than their written comments on what is going right in the class, what is not going right. If something is going right, I want to continue that. And if there is something that is particularly problematic, then I want to know about that as well. There are certain things that I do not ask them about, for example, the curriculum, the content, for example, things that I'm going to cover anyway. However, I ask them about sort of the delivery of the material. If I'm spending too little or too much time on a particular topic, if I'm going too slow or too fast.
So this will be a relief to someone like a Stanley Fish. Again, the blogger we mentioned in the New York Times, there's been a sort of an ongoing conversation about evaluations. And he worries, first of all, that students might be considered sages before their time and asked about content. But you're saying that's not what you're doing. You're talking about teaching.
Absolutely. So content is off limits. Curriculum is off limits. So I set the content and curriculum before I see any of them, and I give it to them, and we stick to that. However, there are other issues. For example, there are practical issues. If I'm speaking too slowly, if I'm speaking too fast, if I am using colors which may be problematic to colorblind students.
Well, this happened, didn't it?
That did.
What happened?
So I still don't know who that individual was when I used to teach at University of Texas, and I was using green and red colors, not knowing sort of the male colorblinding colors. And this particular individual, I still do not know who that individual is because these surveys are anonymous, said that he cannot see the differences that I'm trying to illustrate on the board. And I felt horrible. I felt disappointed in myself that I should have known and been more considerate and sensitive to these things. And nobody likes to talk about their disabilities. So these are the issues that come up.
What else have you learned from your students in this feedback?
So there are other issues. For example, most recently in my class, when I felt that the readings were obvious and simple, the students felt that they were incomprehensible. So what I did was I did not change the readings. I gave them additional readings so that they could learn the readings that were required for the class.
Well, this brings us, you know, to the criticism. Do you feel you might have dumb down your class for your students? Because again, Stanley Fish, you know, one of many who wonders about evaluation, says that sometimes effective teaching involves deliberately inducing confusion, withholding clarity, refusing to provide answers, you know, because this is a process of inquiry for the students.
I think Stanley is absolutely right. However, in my defense, I would say that this particular class I was teaching for the first time. Typically, I teach in the Department of Biomedical Engineering. This was in the Honors College, where there were two engineers out of a group of 53. So I had not dealt with philosophy and English and hospitality management students. So it was very hard for me to really realize where they're coming from. I did not change any of the readings. The readings remained the same, but I gave them a set of definitions that allowed them to understand those readings a little bit better so they could discuss them in the class. Yeah. So the content remains the same. I covered the same material. I actually gave them more material than I would have otherwise. So in some ways, instead of dumbing it down, I added more material on their plate in an effort to make sure that they're able to comprehend the basic things.
As you know, there are thousands of professors who are thinking along these lines. I need to get more feedback. There's a K. Patricia Cross's one-minute paper approach. This is at the end of every class. A student's asked to write down the most important thing they learned that day and the biggest question left unanswered. In other words, the thing they didn't learn that day but still would like to know. Did you look into some of these other ways of evaluating?
I did. And I think part of it is cultural. Depending on which department, which subject you're teaching, there are different nature of kinds of questions because we tend to do a lot more problems in the class than discussion. The nature of engineering teaching is such. Mm-hmm. So not every class is going to be sort of the same. Sometimes you sort of leave things intentionally and come back to the next class, and sometimes the students have to do it themselves. I used to do it once a month, and I sort of decreased the time, and I do it every 2 weeks now. And I think one can do it in every class, but I'm not sure if I'll get the necessary feedback because there's some time that is necessary for it to internalize before I can ask them that whether the questions and the concerns that they had, I have addressed them. And doing it at a sort of a regular interval.
And were you aware of other teachers? I'm thinking of at Columbia University, there's Lee Neffelkamp. You're shaking your head, yes.
I was familiar with some of the work that Lee had done, and I saw that in the Times article, sort of giving a little bit of a note card at the end of every lecture, every few weeks, what is working for you and what is not working for you. Again, I have essentially the same kind of approaches, but I give them a little bit more time than sort of a 3x5 and ask them to really say what are some of the challenges, both right. in my teaching and the material. I'm not going to change the material, but the delivery might change a little bit to address their concerns.
Do you have a numeric rating as well? Do you calculate all this?
I do, but it's not for students to see. That's for my own purposes to see how I'm doing. So I keep the surveys anonymous. No student gets to see what someone else has or has not written. The scoring is for me to see how am I doing, just to get a numerical analysis of that. And I do that for myself, but students never get to see that.
So in other words, you got to score a great number, a 10 on delivery, but maybe a 5 on explaining something,
sure.
Something like that.
Sure. So I asked them to score me on two things. One is the class itself, and second is teaching. So I don't ask them to grade me specifically on how am I doing on problems versus overall material. So the overall is the class, whether they are learning something, and two is teaching and delivery, whether I'm able to convey the topics that I am supposed to cover in an effective manner, in a manner that is conducive to their learning.
When you get a really bad feedback, how does that make you feel?
I think part of my job and one of the things that I have evolved over the years is to have a pretty thick skin. And I think that's part of the process. You do get students who think that I'm either too boring or too difficult or it's too simplistic. You get contradictory feedback from students. And my job is to tell them and explain how am I doing the things that I'm doing. And this is not a mechanism or a means for them to get a job. It's about fundamental knowledge. And I think that very feeling is appreciated by students, that I'm able to convey the big picture and the message.
That's, you know, again, when someone says you're too difficult, you might be saying, yeah.
Well,
it's a difficult field.
It is a difficult field, but I think if it is difficult, it should be fair. So I shouldn't say that I am sort of testing them or I'm asking them to do things which are unfair. As long as I'm fair, even if the concepts are difficult, I think that's fine.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that they need to appreciate as students in a good university and in a rigorous discipline.
Mohammed Zaman, a professor of biomedical engineering at Boston University, who collects student feedback every couple of weeks to make himself a better professor. Professor Zaman, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And if you're a student, give us some feedback. Do you appreciate these evaluations, or do you think, why are they asking me? I'm the student. HereAndNow.org. Back in a minute. Here and Now. Welcome back. And some quick housekeeping to start. First of all, I just said the Kentucky Derby was in Lexington. It is, of course, in Louisville, Kentucky. And yesterday we spoke with Esquire magazine columnist Stephen Marsh about what he called the war against youth, in part corporate America taking advantage of young people through internships. Now, Stephen said that, for instance, Disney has the money to pay interns, implying they don't. Well, we heard from listener Sarah Pennington from Richmond, Virginia, who told us as a college student more than 10 years ago, she had two paid internships at Disney. She writes, I didn't get rich and I worked hard, but in return, she says she took management classes and got valuable experience that, she says, launched her career in marketing. And a Disney spokesperson has confirmed with us that Disney does, in fact, pay all of its thousands of interns. Again, not much. Well, in response, columnist Stephen Marsh emailed us that paying somebody a few hundred a month is not a moral distinction. He stands by his claim that internships are pseudo-employment. They take jobs from adults. And we feel compelled to say that we have unpaid interns here at Here and Now, and we really appreciate them. Ah, math, square roots, the Pythagorean theorem, and algebra. If train A leaves town X and train B leaves town Y, when will they meet in town Z if they're going 30 miles an hour? Ack. But what if you and three friends are being chased by zombies and you had to figure out how to cross a rope bridge in the dark with only one flashlight? What if you were tied to a table trying to calculate the descent of a pendulum that threatened to cut you in half? Or were worried about how long it would take the new resident vampire to make the entire town undead? These crisis calculations are all problems in the Book of Perfectly Perilous Math, 24 death-defying challenges for young mathematicians. Author Sean Connolly joins us from KUHF in Houston, Texas, with more. Sean, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, it sounds like a play on the book, The Dangerous Book for Boys. This is for boys and girls. But when did you get the idea of putting peril and math together?
Well, this is the third, and I wouldn't call it quite a series, but it's the third like-minded books I've written, two of which were in science, and this is now the math one. So we had the book of Totally Irresponsible Science, and then Potentially Catastrophic Science. Perfectly Perilous Math also has the benefit of alliteration, so we're keeping the stakes raised in this sort of series.
Ah, you mentioned stakes, so let's go to your vampire problem first. And you have a vampire coming to a town of 500,000 people. The vampire feeds only twice a month, but those people turn into vampires as well. So the question is, if the vampires feed only on people in your town, remember it was a town of 500,000, approximately how many months will it take for your 500,000-person town to become populated entirely by vampires? So what do we do here?
Well, think about what the facts are that you do know. There's currently only one vampire in town. Mm-hmm. There are 500,000 people living in the town, and every month one vampire feeds on two humans, turning them into vampires. Add those to the original vampire, you have three. The following month, each of these three vampires will then transform two more into vampires, two more humans, making six.
Mm-hmm.
These get added to the original three, and the total vampire population would be nine. These nine, in turn, turn two more humans into vampires by the end of the third month, making the population 27. There's beginning to be a pattern. And if you think that V, I'm sorry if people hate those letters creeping in here, but this is a neat way of doing it quickly. V would equal the number of vampires, and X would equal the total number of vampires. V times 2 plus V, so in other words, the number of vampires times 2 plus the number of vampires equals X.
Ah.
So X is the total number of vampires at the end of any given period. So you can work it out. You can also form a table if you find it easier, just to make it a bit more schematic, where you have month one, month two, current vampires, new vampires, and then the total, which is the current plus the new equal the new total. And the number gets big very quickly.
Yeah, it's exponentially. It just blows up. Yep. Mm-hmm.
By the end of 1 year, the number is 531,441 total vampires.
So kids have the fun of figuring out that equation, and you help them with that. And then they get to see this, their entire town. Oh, my God, it could take – it's just a year in which your entire town could be taken over by vampires. Everybody run. It's fun. And in others, you also give them, in addition to the problem, there's a little bit of do-it-yourself in case you want to make your own pendulum, for instance. Let's look at that problem. This is, you know, straight out of Edgar Allan Poe. A pendulum blade is 15 inches above their chest, lowering 1 inch with each swing. While a rat is chewing through the rope that's holding you on the table, it's going to take the rat 60 seconds to chew through that rope. So will that rat get you out of the rope before the pendulum swings and cuts you in half?
That's it in a nutshell. And you know the rate of rat gnawing, you know that's a minute. And you know the rate of the pendulum, that each swish is 7 seconds long. And you also know how much each swish brings the pendulum closer to you. So it's a question of working out these two rates, basically. You know how long it will take for the rat to gnaw through the rope. You also know how much more the blade must lower before it reaches you.
By the way, we'll have the answers and the problems at hereandnow.org for those of you saying, quick, you know, to get the victim off the table before the pendulum swings down. And by the way, they're not all, you know, vampires and pit and pendulum. One of the problems is the pizza peril. This is right out of The Devil Wears Prada. It's a young girl on her first day at Catwalk magazine. She's working for the toughest editor in the business. She has to take a lump sum of money and go buy pizza and then figure out, you know, how to divide up the slices. But how do you see it affecting kids?
Well, first of all, I've written these somewhat in collaboration with my own children. I've got girl-boy twins, and with that come all those gender preconceptions. And in this case, we do sometimes fight a losing battle, or at least a difficult battle, to convince my daughter, Anna, that she is actually very capable in math and science. And also, we need to get her brother, Thomas, who I wouldn't say he's a complete tinkerer with things, but he's the one who will read occasionally a nonfiction book. We want him to be reading. So we're looking for a merger here, really. We want someone who's comfortable with words to branch out into math. And then also the same thing happened in the other direction.
Oh, interesting. So does it work?
I'm getting compliments from parents and godparents and some teachers who say that it seems to be doing the trick, that this book gets girls interested in math and boys interested in reading. It's very rewarding, and personally so for me with my own family situation.
Well, that's what I was asking. So did it work with the twins, with your kids?
It does, actually, and it might be, in each case, it could be a slightly different collaboration or a little bit of inspiration. It might just be that follow-on, that do-it-yourself aspect that you described. We call them the math labs. For example, the one with the vampires. I draw people's attention back to the man who invented chess 2,000 years ago, and his reward, all he wanted from the king, was one grain of rice on the first square of the new chessboard, two on the second, four on the third, and so forth. I get kids to do it, including my own kids, and it brings home, they get to about the fifth square and they get bored doing rice because eventually it's going to turn into 18 pentillion if you fill the square, all the squares.
Really?
Yeah, it's a huge number. But, you know, even when we got to about four or five squares with my daughter, she was the one who was really getting a kick out of it and was really trying to work out, or at least hazard a guess of how much the total would reach.
Yeah. And it was it 18 pentillion?
18 pentillion, 446 quadrillion, 744 trillion, 73 billion, 709 million, 551,615.
That's a lot of rice.
That is a lot of rice.
We're talking with Sean Connolly about the book of Perfectly Perilous Math, 24 Death-Defying Challenges for Young Mathematicians. As we said, we'll post a few at hereandnow.org. Puzzle them out with your kids. Sean, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's take it to the right of the decimal point. We've got 10. Thousands, ten thousands, hundred thousands. Come on.